Welcome to a special live version of the Next CMO podcast, recorded at Drift headquarters in Boston. That's proof that we're actually in a live event. The Next CMO is a community for innovative marketing professionals who are or would like to be the next generation of marketing leadership. Today, we are thrilled and honored to welcome a special guest who personifies the Next CMO and is committed to helping mentor and educate the future crop of CMOs. So please join me in welcoming the CMO of Fuse, Mr. Brian Carden.
Hey, thank you. Good to be here.
Great. Thank you, Brian. I'm thrilled that you're here. So Brian and I have known each other for about 150 years,
yeah,
I think.
A long time.
And I'll give you a little bit of his background, but then I'll ask you to fill in some of the blanks along the way. I met Brian when he was the CMO of a little company called Eloqua. But Brian was also the CMO of a company called Lattice Engines, also a very successful company. The CMO of a company called Forrester Research that we probably all know about. And he did a bunch of other things along the way. But those are the areas where actually someone just in the audience said that there should be a Brian Carden Index. I would invest in that. It was the companies that Brian has worked in have seemed to do pretty well. We'll find out if it's correlation or causation later. We'll make a judgment after we talk to Brian. So welcome, Brian. Thrilled to have you. And so what did I miss about your background that would be important?
Well,
for
first, I have
to
mention something about Peter. Peter's one of my favorite people. I've never told you this, but he reinvents himself. So CMO for many years, very successful, and general manager running a very exciting business within Nuance, and entrepreneur. And I'd say some of the things I like most during the week is watching your high-energy videos. It's unbelievable. And so I think the quality that you have that I love in the Next CMO is this idea of curiosity and asking a lot of questions and being a kid again. And so in you, I see this sort of teenager, you know, this kid who's tinkering and how does this work? Like, look at you, you got the headset on, you got your iPad, you're starting a business. I really admire that. I think that's really essential to be a CMO. Like everything we learned in school has changed and you have to reinvent yourself every once in a while. And you're a great example of that.
Well, thank you, Brian. I've been told that I am chronologically 53-ish, but developmentally about 13. So that's appropriate. So what did I miss in your background that's important to, besides that you know me, which is pretty important, I think. That may be, you know, the capstone, the rubric that your life should be known. New Peter Mahoney.
Yes.
Besides that, CMO of a bunch of cool places and a musician.
My mother was an opera singer and my father was a surgeon. So it's very interesting. Because my father was a surgeon, he would never play ball with me. Violins begin. So, hey, Dad, want to play baseball? No, I can't. My hands or fingers, you know. And then my mother was an opera singer, so they thought the perfect thing would be me to be an accompanist. And so on Sunday, yeah, sissy boy, beyond words. So every weekend, all the kids are playing ball. They're knocking on the window. Can Brian come out and play? And I'm like accompanying my mother for all these arias. And so if you ever need to be accompanied in La Traviata, or La Boheme, or any of the Italian operas. I'm pretty good at that. So I love music very much. And then I'm very good right brain and left brain. So I think most marketers have a major. They either major in sort of data and marketing technology and demand gen, or they're very good at communication and messaging. And I think one thing that's held true for most of my career as a marketer, I'm pretty good on both sides. I love to write. I love to edit videos. But I'm very good at figuring out conversion rates and using artificial intelligence and writing code and getting into the whole stack and understanding how it all works. So I like both sides of it.
That makes a ton of sense. And I was going to get into this later, but I'll bring it up now. The fact that, so I've got a bunch of college-ish age kids. One is just graduating. And what I always tell them, or try to tell them anyway, is when they say, talk about college and what should we do? And I'm a big believer in liberal arts education, and I think that I think that it's really important to be very well-rounded, and especially my son's just finishing up at a Jesuit school, Loyola in Maryland, and a great experience there. And one of the things that's great about a school like that is that you learn some classics, you learn to write, you need learn to be persuasive. You also learn some philosophy and theology and some core things. And I think the future CMO is really about that. You have to be sort of a liberal arts all around kind of marketer to be successful in that world.
I'm just thinking about the Jesuit. My daughter went to school and she's now a sommelier. And so she's drinking all the time. So she weighs all of 85 pounds and she just drinks me under the table. I think one thing that's, I knew nothing about wine when my daughter started studying wine. And so I've studied wine and taken courses and all this sort of stuff. And so one thing that my kids always say, Dad, if we're interested in something, you also have an interest in that. It's part of my curiosity. So I've studied, we do tastings together, and it's really interesting. We travel together and meet winemakers and everything. So I think that's part of my DNA. Is I'm curious about many things. And if my kids have an interest, I follow that. But if my marketing team has an interest in some area of machine learning or some new technology or live chat, I follow them down and I let them sort of, you know, bring on things.
So yeah, I think that's really important, that curiosity and interest in learning all the time, lifetime learning, et cetera, I think is really critical. So just briefly for, you know, the one or two people who don't know what Fuse is, just remind us what Fuse is all about.
Yeah, Fuse is cloud-based communication. So it's voice, group messaging, and video in the cloud. You think about Zoom or GoToMeeting or any of those things, Skype. And you think about that's the video side, and Slack or HipChat or any of those products, Chatter, and then also voice. So it's on the cloud, and we focus on the enterprise. So very large deals. Our average deal is $300,000 a year, and it's a three-year deal. So the total contract value is about $1 million. So as a marketer, it's not high velocity at all, and I'm willing to pay a lot of money to get a meeting with the decision maker. So it's very different than other businesses. So one thing I found, I think you have too, is, you know, all of us as marketers have a playbook, and we sort of like, hey, here are my tricks, and here's what I can do, and here's what really works. But sometimes that playbook isn't going to work for the new gig. And I've seen a lot of marketers fail. They bring their existing playbook to new job, and it's a wrong one. And so for this one, I really had to bring out the target accounts and much more the large buying teams that buy our product. And it's a lot of face-to-face and a lot of relationship stuff. It's not as much digital. You know, we're not, you know, cranking out, you know, 50,000, you know, inbound leads from a demo on the website and converting them with credit cards. It's not the business we're in. It's enterprise, long sales cycles, just a different mindset. But it's very important to understand what you're doing and not to bring out the old playbook. I've seen sales leaders do the same thing. Like, they were successful at four jobs. Here's my playbook. And they put it on the table and they fail miserably. So you got to, I think, really understand the setting you're in and apply the right tools.
I think, first of all, you're right on, of course, Brian. But one thing that I was wondering is there's the playbook that you're going to have to, of course, you pick a marketing strategy, you pick your plays that are aligned with that strategy. But at the same time, you've been a CMO at multiple companies for a couple of decades now, sorry to remind you. And I wonder, outside of just applying different plays, the craft has changed pretty significantly over time. Tell me a little bit about what you think has changed at sort of the highest level from when you were back at Eloqua or before, all the way to where you are at Fuse about marketing.
So just briefly, you set it up here, but after graduate school, I became a consultant for a large consulting firm, became a partner, and I was traveling all the time. We just had twin boys, and I was traveling, didn't get to know them for the first 6 months of their life, didn't like that. And so Spencer Stewart, the headhunter, called me about a CMO job at a $5 billion business called Reed Elsevier. They own LexisNexis, a whole bunch of things. And for me, that was very exciting. So I never grew up in a marketing organization. I went laterally from a consultant to CMO of a very big company. And that first company was making the change from physical to digital. So they had a lot of print magazines. They had Variety. They had American Baby. They had all these things. So they bought LexisNexis and a whole bunch of things. And then, and so that was a big shift. That was sort of this first sort of phase one of marketing, moving from analog, physical to digital. The next big one is we all became modern marketers. So we discovered marketing automation and a whole bunch of tools. We built our MarTech stack, and we could talk the language of serious decisions of MQLs and conversion rates. And we sort of had that lingo going really well. And so I'm asking the question, what is postmodern marketer? Like, what are we doing next? So for me, I look at what all of us are doing, if we're in B2B marketing at least. You know, we have our SLAs, we got a good sales leader. We're doing lots of digital ads. We're doing email nurturing. We're lead scoring. And still, according to Sirius, 96% of our MQLs will never convert. So something's broken here. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about not just to have a little tiny improvement, but how can I have a step function improvement? So all the little things matter. So we do, like a lot of us, A-B testing on our website, A-B testing on subject heads. We're doing all these things, and you can crank out slightly higher. You know, you do different kinds of digital ads, different calls to action, different things. But I'm interested in sort of these big leaps. So I'm asking the question now, what is sort of postmodern? We're all modern marketers, and really proud that we understand our funnels and how those things work. But there's got to be something better, because essentially when 96% of your leads don't convert, it's failure time. And I don't think we always admit that.
So I have a theory on this. It actually was one of the things that drove me to build the company that I'm in right now. And the theory is that as marketers, we're often drilled down very quickly into the tactics. In fact, Ryan and I had a conversation earlier about this, about how do you measure the effectiveness? What's the ROI of a tactic? And it's actually the wrong question to ask. And I think what happens is you have people focused on their one little process. I'm going to get an MQL, an MQL, an MQL. And they miss the forest for the trees. Yeah. So they're focused on the individual little tactic instead of the broad campaign theme, which is why what we tried to build is something that allows you to sort of organize your plans and budgets into broad campaign themes in a very visual way, because it sort of pulls people in that direction. And I had this scary moment where I used to, I don't know if it was scary for me or the poor marketing managers, I used to do these walkabouts, and I'd go to the marketing manager and say, what are you working on? And they'd go, oh, God, no. And they'd say, well, you know, here's my list of stuff. And I'd look at it, and I said, that looks like a list of stuff. And they said, yeah. And I said, well, what does that have to do with increasing our market share in this new emerging market that's important for us? They go, I don't know. You know, and so that's part of the problem. I think we're focused really narrowly on the tactics, and it's very, very hard, especially as you get a more complex organization. But even as you start to get beyond a couple of people, it's really hard to pull people up and make them think about that. I don't know, am I crazy?
With all due respect,
yes,
I think that's a leadership issue.
Ah,
you know, you're walking around, yeah, and the person's doing what they were told to do, and you're the, yeah, leader. Maybe, sure, you didn't communicate well, like how their little piece fits into something, you know, larger. Because, yeah, I know when my team fails, I always look at myself. I don't blame sales for their SLA didn't follow up enough or something. What could I have done differently? So I take responsibility for everything that goes wrong, and I try to say, what could I have done differently? And so you may not necessarily, yeah, have, you know, been wrong there, but I do what you do. I walk around, they say, what are you working on? And nothing seems to be connected. Everyone's in their own little silo. They're doing their own little piece of the world. They think that really matters, but it's not bubbling up too much.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? You brought up this idea of, I completely agree, the failure in leadership is, one, it's a huge fear that you have as being a CMO, and two, I think it's always a big factor, right? Everyone has a imposter syndrome thing, right, going on, and I think in every job, and in that role, it's really difficult. One of the things I was going to ask you down deeper when we got towards the end of this and when you were practically in tears, we were going to get to this point where I was going to talk about your biggest regret, right? So what is the thing that you look back on in your career and say, oh, I wish I did that differently?
It's a great question. I think there were some personnel decisions that I didn't handle the right way. I think I've learned how to have done them differently. So basically, you know, I make the rookie mistake, and I still have a problem with this. I hire too fast and I fire too slow. You know, I think a lot of us are in sort of that position to do. So I take a lot more time now interviewing and meeting people and understanding what makes them tick. I do a lot more background checks and references and trying to find connections and everything. And then sometimes I've hired rock stars, and they didn't collaborate. And marketing, if it is nothing else, it is teamwork. And you can't get individual rock stars. You've all got to work together. So in several situations, of course, I repeated my failure with different people in different settings, but I would hire a rock star who was an amazing marketer in that particular area, and no one could work with them. And I tolerated it too long. So sometimes you have to tolerate someone who is maybe not that great, maybe a click down, but the overall team works much more, much better. So I've made that mistake as well. made a lot of mistakes.
Yeah, I think we all have. If I look back, and I've certainly made some bad decisions when it came to people, and I'm looking out in the audience, I should be careful because several people who've worked for me in the past are here. The bad decision is I didn't hire you soon enough. How's that? But I think the other thing, if I look back, one of the things, especially when you're at an executive level at a company, one of the things that's most important to do and sometimes the hardest thing to do is to convince the company to do something they're not comfortable doing. And if I look back, so I worked for 13 years for this company, Nuance, and I look back, and every once in a while I go, can't believe those stupid people aren't more successful. And then I realize I should look at myself and say, well, what could have I done, right? What are the things that I, you know, why didn't I push harder in those areas? Because, again, going back to my belief that my kids should have a broad education, one of the things that's important for you to be able to do as an emerging leader in a company is one of the most important skills is selling a complex concept. Right, and that's not about selling my pencil, but it's about convincing an organization to do something that they're otherwise uncomfortable doing. And some of the biggest leaps in success come after you actually convince someone to do something very different.
I find that in a new role, be curious what you think, you have sort of a get out of jail free card for the first 6 months. And so I find that I can make a lot bolder moves in my first 6 months. So if you're going to be very bold, I would do that. The company I'm at now was originally called Thinking Phones, and I couldn't stand the name, but I knew our founder, who I really love. He came up with it like 12 years ago, and it was a very emotional thing. So I had to work with the board, and I had to find the name and do a whole bunch of things. So that was very difficult to do, but I did it the first 6 months. I've done other things like that very early on. So like a lot of jobs, you're in a new role, and this is the time to really make a change, and you're an advocate for change. And but there are several different kinds of marketers, as you know. You know, some just like to maintain things and they keep the trains running and they make it a little bit better. But I think you're someone who wants to get bold ideas and a lot of change across. But how do you feel about that 6 month? And can you still, you know, you were at Nuance and you were there for many years. Are they still listening to you? Can you be as bold in your fifth year as your first year?
Yeah, part of my strategy is always changing jobs inside a company just fast enough so that you don't get stuck with accountability of any kind, right? So you have enough time to have that new car smell for a while. Boy, he's really smart. And then it gets to, boy, I don't know. And then, boy, he's annoying. Oh, my God. And the time to change jobs, right? So, but I agree. There's definitely, you get a free pass early on. And I think it's important to, because we all know, especially if you're in a big company, it's really hard because you lose that perspective of the outside. And when you get a new person in, you just want to talk to them all day long and say, what's it like out there? and you want to get that input. And you can even do that when you change around internally, but it's hard. And I'm actually a big believer in if you want to grow in a company, if I look at the periods where I grew most in my career, it's those times that I actually took very different jobs and changed things up pretty significantly. And before I ask another question, I'm just reminding myself that we have this really cool thing. So this is, what do we call this, Drift People, Gar? It's a thing. It is a, wait a minute, it's a catch box, they call it, or catch mic, or something like that. So we have this little soft cube. I'm not sure how soft it is, so I won't throw it very hard. And I'm going to throw it to Ryan over there to see if he can catch it, because he looks like he's alert. And anyone who has a question, just reach out to these guys. You can throw the catch box, and we can take some. Lisa has one over there as we get going. And we're seeing how good we are at catching the catch box over here. So Lisa apparently had a parent who's a surgeon and a parent who's an opera
that
singer.
That
goes with a hand. So and first, for the people who on this, both our listeners to our podcast who don't know who you are, why don't you just say who you are quickly and ask?
Lisa Skinner, head of growth at Tamer. When you're at an early stage, growth stage company, and really your primary focus is to drive pipeline and revenue, like how do you know when it's the right time to invest in the brand? And thinking about, you know, core messaging and the visual identity and really making sure that you don't wait too long to do that. But also, you know, I almost feel like it's something you need to earn because folks are so focused on the numbers. I'm struggling with this now and would love your perspective.
It's a great question. And you have as much to say, if not more, than I do. But my perspective is that investing in the brand, I think, in the early stage is the product experience. So the best thing you can do as a marketer say, hey, thanks for giving me money for advertising. I'd rather put it into a great product experience because these become referenceable customers. There's great word of mouth. People have a great product experience. So I think that's really important. The other thing with the brand is if you have target accounts you're interested in doing, you don't really have to buy a lot of wide advertising. You can buy it very precisely and surgically. So there are ways to get just to target accounts through obviously LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, different social platforms, different advertising platforms. And there are a lot of people here who really know how to do that well. So I think you can get very surgical about how to do that. And then again, it's about the product experience, that early days. I've been in some companies where we made the mistake of marketing too well and a crappy product was in the hands of too many people. The best way to kill a company is with a bad product and great marketing. So everyone's got it and they're trier rejectors. And now the market is flooded with people who tried your product and they're bad-mouthing you. They're, you know, not promoters, they're detractors. And that really can hurt you. So if your product is ready for prime time, you know, that's one thing. If it's not quite good enough, I would invest money in making sure there's an amazing product experience doing it that way. And then I'm also a believer in earned media versus paid media. I think there are enough ways to earn media versus pay for it. I think paying for a lot of media in a lot of cases, particularly for a small growth company, is sort of a sucker play.
I think Apple just finally got over the Newton, by the way.
That's a good example.
Exactly.
So, does anybody remember the Newton, or is it just Peter and I?
Just
okay,
old
thank you.
Bless Wait
you,
a minute, I just
you.
Called you all old. I apologize. So I think you're exactly right, as usual, Brian. It's annoying. To that, I just add the fact that you alluded to one element, one additional element of the brand. It's the product experience. But a brand, of course, is much bigger. And I know this isn't what Lisa meant, but it's much bigger than what the logo looks like or what the tagline is. It's actually the full manifestation of your strategy and your purpose of being, which means it's all these different things. So with that in mind, I'd say that getting alignment in your company around what your purpose for being is and how you operate and who you are and what your strategy is, that part of the brand I think is incredibly important to get aligned with early. And it's easy to do when you're small because alignment is easier when you have less people to align with. But getting that rock solid is really important. And then the other points that Brian made are really right on about you can narrow cast an investment. When it comes to creating an external awareness for that brand and packaging the brand, there are things that you can do to very cost effectively do that. But I think investing early in the foundational parts of the brand that make that up, I think are incredibly important. One reason is that the further you get away from that, it's like a giant game of telephone, and you can spend years trying to undo a misunderstanding or a disconnect between different parts of your organization. It's really, really tricky to do. So one other question for you, Brian, while other people are thinking, I think we probably got the throw around thing fixed too, is for people who, especially who are earlier in their career, what do you look at for a marketing leader? What are the attributes of someone who you look to hire for a senior marketing position in your world? What are the key things that you look at?
Great communicator. I think as we all know, marketing can really have great results, but if they can't communicate it, and this idea of the marketing of marketing, none of us are really very good. I think a lot of us are too modest, and how you present the results and how you share it and do things with sales. So I think the communication piece is really key. Everyone in the market team is an ambassador for marketing. You got to get along with everyone, and so you really have to be a good communicator. The second one is, you know, that old line, I think Deming said, in God we trust, all others bring data. So I'm very much, I love data, and before we had data, there was anecdote. I can't stand, you know. So our sales leader at a lot of companies, they have a great story, and I say, I don't care, you know, about your cute story. But people remember stories, sometimes CEOs and sales leaders love the anecdote and the story. I really don't have time for that. You know, it shows a lack of data. So we're in such a great era. We have all the data. You don't have to guess anymore. It's there in black and white. So I love people who present a great case and don't overwhelm me with too much data, because every one of these tools in our stack has thousands of metrics. And so they're able to know how to tell a story with just a few pieces of numbers that matter. So I like the data piece. And then this idea about collaboration, I think, really matters a great deal. People have respect. And the other thing reminds me of your person on your team. You went around, what are you doing, and doing this, that they have to understand the bigger picture, that they can be really good technically, but they have to understand what is marketing trying to do and understand the company goals. Those are some of the things that I look for.
It's funny. One of the things, getting that perspective of others is really important. And one of the things that I really encourage marketers to do in their careers is do something different. Go to professional services. Go to sales. Go to engineering. Go to some administrative function. Go do something different, because it gives you just a much broader perspective of the world. I did this. This is something I don't know if I'd do again. It was kind of a weird experiment. I guess it kind of worked. I was at a company called PictureTel.
Oh, sure.
Probably knew those guys. And I had a team of product marketers, and I think there were 10 of them. And they each had their own product. And they were so stuck in their way. I said to them one time in a meeting, okay, you have your product, write it down on a piece of paper in front of you. Everyone pass it to your right. That's your new product. And I changed everyone's product. And it actually was mostly good. You know, it was really interesting. But just getting a different perspective, I think, is really important. And someone has the drift box, so I think we have another question.
Let's see if it, there we are.
Very nice.
My name is Krista, and I work at Shopify Plus, which is the enterprise version of the software. And I'm new to Boston, so I'm still kind of figuring this all out.
Welcome to Boston, Krista.
Boston.
Where are you from, Krista?
We're wicked cool.
I moved from Canada. Yeah, far off Canada.
Very nice.
Thank you. So I don't currently work in marketing. I'm in accounts and customer success, but I come from a marketing background. So as you say, trying to get some perspective. And what I'm really passionate about right now in Boston is growing our community through experiential marketing. And I did this a lot when I worked at Lululemon. I think it's something they do incredibly well, but I feel like I'm fighting an uphill battle right now. And I think this is a great case study as to why those pieces work. So can you elaborate a little bit more on experiential marketing and why you think it works?
What did Lululemon do for experiential marketing? What kind of things do they do?
So I think a lot of what they do kind of goes back into their brand and feeling like you belong to something bigger. And when I talk about experiential marketing, I think that's the real value, is bringing people into the community so that they identify. So it's more than saying I use Shopify. It's saying I'm an iPhone user. Right? If you think about Apple, iPhone users are fanatical and they are always at the top of the market buying new products. So it's how do you create that through the experience of using the product?
So you want them to be part of the brand community.
Yes.
Somehow, right? That
yes.
would be another way to talk about it. Yeah. It's so, by the way, I think companies like Drift have done a really great job with this. They find ways to sort of create these experiences and events for their customers to bring them in. They're very educational about the way they do things. They have Hypergrowth, which is their event, which is sort of like a super giant version of this with much fancier people than me and Brian up on the stage, who are much more expensive doing things. And as a result, they create this real community and people feel like they're drifters, right? They're part of that world. So it can be a really powerful thing to do, and it's hard to do at scale. But I think there are little things that you can do to make people feel like they're part of the team. One way to do that is to include people in product feedback, as an example. If they're existing customers, give them a good opportunity to be on a product feedback board. Right, that's something that maybe they're not, you know, part of a whole movement, but they feel like, yeah, I'm contributing to this thing, and they start to pull it in a little bit closer. So things like that, I think, can make a really big difference.
That's great. Thank you.
Yeah. something that you and I share is we're both kind of nerds, right? And I think that that is a sort of this analytical view of the world. But like you said, you need to have a major and a minor, right? You need to also be able to think strategically. You need to be able to write and convince and things like that. But what are some of the other things that you think someone who is early in their career, and if you say the one or two skills you really need to acquire to be a CMO 10 years from now, what do you think that would be?
I think this idea of being a very quick learner in things. So the things we learned in school aren't at all applicable anymore. Yeah. Everything's changed. And so there are new tools, new techniques. So this idea that we talked earlier about reinventing yourself constantly and being curious. So, and then throughout your career, you got to dig in and do the work. And that means understanding how all the technology works and how all the numbers work. And you can't be superficial. So whenever we get a new, you know, piece of technology, I get the login, I go in, I make a million mistakes. I also don't have a private office. So I'm given a private office and we use it as conference room because I have no business being in a private office. I love to be able to hear what everyone's saying. They can hear me on the phone all day and we just learn from each other constantly. Of our 12 executive team members, I'm the only one without who chose not to get an office. They're all sitting in their offices. I've told them I think it's really a dumb idea. You ought to be moving around, but they got the door shut and they're on the phone, and I don't really understand that. So I think this idea of curiosity for me is by far the most important attribute to have. I think writing matters too. So you really have to think about messaging and positioning and differentiation and crafting a short sentence and that sort of thing. So I think writing and finding a good choice of words is a very important attribute, regardless of what role you have in life.
I assumed you were going to go into this very technical, wonky world, but I'm thrilled that you didn't, and you focus more on what I think it's those liberal arts skills in a way, and the ability to learn and continue to learn and be voracious about it. I think the technical side of writing, you have to be adult and convincing in your writing. You have to use correct grammar. You have to be professional in the way that you communicate. But the other thing you have to be is persuasive.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the hardest things to teach someone who hasn't learned it. But getting to the point where you can actually. So I think what I like to do for people who are earlier on in my teams is find out if there's something that they're passionate about and say, well, put together a case for me. Tell me why, right? Sell me an idea. And I think, one, you get great ideas from that because people often bring these great perspectives, but you don't often have a chance to do that in the working world. You don't have this, you may have done something in college, but you haven't really been able to use those skills if it's not something you do all the time, and I think it's incredibly important. So any other questions from out here? But we've got someone behind here. Go ahead, Dan.
It was a very quick one.
What's your name and who do you work for, young fella?
My name is Dan and I work for Peter.
Oh, he's the guy in the back of your videos. Exactly. He's like making all the faces behind you. Oh, now it's coming.
I'm the head waver in the videos. No, it's related to the left brain, right brain comment. We were talking to some friends from Cabinet M recently, and we were talking about the emergence of marketing operations. And that does seem to be something that's burgeoning. And is that something that the next CMO should be adept in?
Yeah, so, you know, marketing operations is really the core. It keeps it all running. And there really wasn't a marketing operations function, you know, 12 years ago. So what really began was these series of marketing automations, Marketo, Eloqua, Pardot, whatever you want to call it, these things. Then everything now plugs into everything. It's sort of a key role. I think it's very important, though, that it's not necessarily a technology role. It's asking the business questions and having those questions solved. I've seen too many marketing operations people spit out, you know, hundreds and hundreds of metrics, and they don't have the experience or the skill to ask just the right questions the business needs. And so understanding what your chief revenue officer needs to know, your CEO, your board needs to know is really important. So it can be abused terribly. And then I think all these technology vendors, everything is plug and play. Well, plug and play, but not plug and works well for you. So configuring everything right and just getting everything exactly right is a real art to make it work well. So I think marketing operations is really at the core. I think the question a lot of people now are asking that I'm interested in is, what's the role of machine learning and artificial intelligence and a whole bunch of sort of new areas that are sort of emerging? You know, at this conference today, we were talking about, you know, you can crawl through emails and see sentiment. And you can, you know, there's just a whole bunch of new things that are happening. You know, obviously, bot and chat is something that's very interesting. It's artificial intelligence. If I was choosing a career, I might not choose sales. You know, Forrester had this great research report about 5 years ago called Death of the B2B Salesperson. And they claimed there'd be 1 million less B2B salespeople this year than there were 4 years ago. And so I see it every day. You know, no one wants to talk to a salesperson. So cars, Teslas figure out a way, no salesperson. It's all marketing. You know, travel agents. Anybody old enough to remember when you talk to a human being to book a ticket and a travel thing? And it's like unbelievable. All gone. That's a whole generation of travel agents pretty much wiped out. I think real estate agents are going to be gone pretty soon. It's like, I don't need someone to, like, you know, open the door and say, you know, here's the living room. You know, so I think the whole categories of salespeople that are going away, I think B2B salespeople are going to be very fine-tuned. We're seeing all this credit card, high velocity, premium sort of stuff going on. I don't need a salespeople. And so I think that's something that's going to be replaced. So I'm very interested to see how bots, artificial intelligence can start replacing different kinds of functions.
I think Dan has some ideas on that, by the way. So Dan is our CTO at Plana. And Dan's actually a good example of the left brain, right brain, because he's got a degree in linguistics, right? Speech and language processing, and he ran the speech synthesis research at Nuance, and then went and took a job in marketing. And so he's got a little bit of both and a great understanding. And actually, one of the things that he's convinced us to do is build something we call the marketing graph, which is basically a way to take and connect all of these all this data around what you're going to do with marketing, what's your plan, what's your budget, you know, what's your strategy, all those things, and put it in a graph database. So you actually have the ability to run machine learning algorithms on it in sort of a smart, interesting way. So it's an interesting thing. So a couple things for you, Brian. I talked about sort of the biggest mistake, but I'd love to know about your proudest moment in marketing, in your distinguished career.
So I think we helped create a category of marketing automation. I feel really good about that. So, and you know, we were first early, and then Marketo sort of came along, and we hated them. And it was sort of Coke and Pepsi or Nike and Reebok. But together, you need a competitor. I know we all hate competitors, but it established a category. As we all know, it legitimized the category. So it was actually good for us. And they were very aggressive, and they sort of kicked us in the butt. And so it was just a lot of fun to have a real competitor. And so one thing I've learned, and it's actually a chapter in Behind the Cloud, Mark Benioff's book, is pick a fight. And so it's something I love to do. I love to find like a big company that nobody really likes. It could be Oracle. It used to be Microsoft, but they seem to be doing pretty well, you know, with Satya being rated the best CEO. And talk about a company with a comeback. It's unbelievable. Very few companies have a second act. You know, Netflix had a second act, you know, after physical to digital. Obviously, Apple and Steve Jobs came back. And it looks like Microsoft is doing. Pick a fight is something that I find very important. So I really love those years of building a company. And we went public. We're only doing $60 million a year. The company I'm at right now is going to do a couple hundred million this year. And we're just delaying going public, you know. But I love that time building the team and creating the category. Also, what was so great about Eloqua is that I reinvented myself along the way. I was a much more traditional CMO. I had never worked in technology before. Never worked in software. I was a traditional, came from a big company. I worked at Forrester, nothing to do with selling software. And so the board hired me. They took a big chance on me, and I had to learn really quickly. I had to learn how to sell technology. I wasn't, you know, that sort of person. And so that was sort of my reinvention at a later part of my life. And I'm very, very grateful for all of that.
Great. Excellent. Well, I want to, first of all, thank Brian for his time and sharing his insights. So let's all give Brian a round of applause.
My pleasure. You. Good questions. Thank you
very much. And since we are, I think, still recording this thing, I should probably just wrap up and say that this has been the next CMO podcast, I think. We'll see what happens. You should definitely subscribe and listen more and follow us on Twitter at NextCMO or go to thenextcmo.com and find future meetups. We'd love to see more people come to future meetups, and we love to have the people who came to this first meetup to come back again. And thanks again, Brian, and have a great day.
Thank you.
All right.